First of all, you would agree that it's important to reduce the jail and prison population during this time of coronavirus, but why is that?
So early on, we knew that we wanted to make sure we were reducing the spread of the virus anywhere, right? What we went down from 100% court ops to 15, which meant we weren't doing jury trials, we weren't doing pleas and sentencings, we weren't doing bail reviews until we brought up our three courts, which we finally did, which meant the jail population was starting to creep up. And the House of Correction population was starting to creep up. So we had responsibility as well to look at that to make sure that, number one, there wasn't going to be overcrowding because the more people in the jail and the House of Correction potentially could be carriers, right? The jail also wanted to keep their population to single cells to reduce any kind of ability for the virus to spread if it got into the jail. So we were really conscious about working with them to do that. The House of Correction was more congregate care, so they couldn't really do single cells because there were no cells to put people in. So we knew right away at some point they would start seeing positive COVID numbers there. But it would have been a lot easier, and certainly was, to have less people in the House of Correction. So both of them are down about, I don't know, 650. What was important for us was to make sure that there was no outbreak in the jail or House of Correction that would ultimately mean impacting the hospitals. And if we had a lot of people on from the House of Correction, then jails going to the hospital, it meant less and less beds and more impact on care providers and supplies. So we were really super conscious about that in the beginning. Became part of our public safety analysis. Not just does this offender, are they medium, low, or high risk, but what about the public health piece to this as well that we needed to be conscious about, and we decided that we would. So that was a lot of our work, Carl, wasn't it? It still is. We're still working on it.
It's just it's very upfront in our minds that controlling the population is beneficial not only for the those in custody, but also the staff and their families and the community. And Dr. Swain gave us some really cogent reasons why we needed to pay a lot of attention to.
So what's the framework for like how you decided to have people get released? DA Chisholm, if you maybe want to address that.
Sure. So the first step was just recognizing that we had a serious problem on our hands. And the reality is that every single day prior to the pandemic, thousands of people were coming to the courthouse to get problems resolved one way or the other, not just in the criminal justice system, but in the civil system as well. And as we started having a deeper understanding of how this was impacting places, major urban centers, whether it's Seattle, New York, when the reality of that started to sink in, we knew that we had to take some dramatic steps. The thing that we're responsible for in terms of the well-being of the health of specific individuals is anybody that we've made a determination as a system has to remain in custody pretrial, or who have been sentenced and sent anything less than a year out to the House of Correction. And I shouldn't forget the juvenile detention center. That's important to keep in mind, and we've kept that in our discussions and planning as well. And then the next step was to really defer our traditional decision making to the experts in the public health system. Again, we're all accustomed to making decisions that are consistent with our obligations in our respective fields. For the court, it's they have an obligation to treat everybody that comes before them fairly and to apply the law in the appropriate way. for the public defenders, it's to zealously advocate for their clients. For the DAs, it's to protect the community and protect people's rights at the same time. So everybody has these different responsibilities, but we just added an additional responsibility to it, which was we had to take guidance from public health experts. And they were telling us that if we didn't dramatically reduce the footprint in the courthouse and specifically in the jail and the House of Correction, that we were going to be putting the public at risk. So that's the irony, is that most of our thinking is along those lines of how do we keep the public safe? And here, there was really a conflict in responsibilities. We were basically being told that if you didn't reduce the size of the jail, that you really risked widespread exposure, and that would result in a significant number of people getting sick, and that would result in sending a lot of people to the hospital to take up valuable bed and ventilator space and expose more healthcare workers. And as Tom has pointed out any number of times, that what we also quickly understood is that it wasn't just about taking care of the inmates, that you have correctional officers and nurses and other individuals, you know, people that are cooking and cleaning and doing that work in there. They're not only getting exposed when they're in that setting, but they're out in the community and they have the possibility to bring it back in and spread there. So we just recognized that we had to start taking some dramatic steps to try to do it in a rational and kind of orderly process. We started with the jail, and at the same time we started releasing from the House of Correction. I kind of describe it as pressing a balloon, you know, that so you can reduce in one area, but it could expand in another area. So we knew that if we could go single cell in the jail, that's what the public health people said would help reduce the spread the most. And I just as an aside say, when this is all over, hopefully soon, but, you know, probably not. But when we get when we come up for air and are able to actually assess what's happened, you're going to see a clear distinction about the actions that we took in the jail to allow them to go single cell. And as a result, they've had very little spread in the jail. Whereas in the house where there's congregate living, they've had a much larger outbreak. But it would have been much worse if we hadn't taken the steps that we took to dramatically reduce, starting with the jail, then reducing the House of Correction. And we're even in discussions with the State Department of Corrections to try to help them with theirs, because they have the least flexibility of anyone. So that's kind of our thinking. That's the sort of the imperatives we were operating off of back on, you know, March 12th.
So in layman's terms, for people who aren't familiar with the criminal justice system, you know, what's happening in the criminal justice system for people to be able to get out? I mean, clearly these people weren't getting out before. They're getting out now under public health guidance. Who's getting out and how is it working?
You know, I'd let Carl, because Carl's really been overseeing that one. Both Carl and Tom and one of my deputies, Jeff Altenberg, have been from day one literally going through lists one by one. And so I'll let them talk a little bit about that.
Well, and I'm going to let Tom talk too, because Tom and Jeff Altenberg really have been our gatekeepers to a large extent. They get a list from the house with identified inmates on the list that fall within certain criteria. They have a certain amount of either condition time or a sentence at the house that's within 45 or 60 days of being resolved. In other words, they're going to be out in about 60 days anyway. And the same thing with conditional release. I mean, of those with condition time, it's about to be finished. And so they were going to get out anyway. So all we did is took that list with the guidance of both Tom and Jeff Altenberg, Tom Reed, and reviewed that. Now, I have to tell you, there was some oversight by the chief and the judges, because we brought them into the mix after the DA and the public defender went through and kind of whittled the list down. Then we talked to our colleagues about it. They were informed about the issues that have been articulated by John and the chief, that this is what we're facing. So let's be informed about whether we can make some changes. And there was buy-in to support reducing that footprint. So what I'm saying is, it wasn't willy-nilly. It was done judiciously and painstakingly. And I'll turn it over to Tom because he was doing some of that heavy lifting.
So what I think I would say about it is that, you know, as a result of COVID-19, we have really studied in a much more in-depth way exactly who is in the jail and the House of Corrections. And it's not that we weren't scrutinizing that before. I want to be really clear, because we were. But, you know, the necessity of reducing the population to meet the objectives that John described required us to get a regular look at these various categories. So you have people who are sentenced, people who whose sentence involves some time as a condition of their probation in the community. We also have been looking closely at people who are on pretrial status, because even with the reduced footprint in the courts, we recognize that one way to create some more room is to resolve a few cases where that can be done. And when you look very closely at each of those groups, I think you are able, we have been able to find examples of where the public safety risk of having someone released a little bit early, or in a smaller group of people released on bail or having their case resolved, was fairly low. That is, we're not talking about situations where there was a lot of concern about victim safety or some other concern like that. And the people who have been recommended for release in the main are people who have already served quite a bit of their sentence. So this isn't the case that somebody who has been in for 10 days is getting out instead of serving 60 days. This is a situation where somebody maybe had to do 120 days and they've done 75 days and they're not, or 80 days and their last part of their sentence is going to be stayed. And the result of all those efforts has been to create enough room to in the jail and House of Corrections to offset the people coming in. Because one thing that we know is a reality is, unfortunately, people continue to be arrested. And because of the various efforts to control the population, most of the people arrested and booked into the jail today are there on fairly serious matters. And without having a full court system and speedy trial apparatus and all the things that would allow us to resolve those cases quickly, if we don't pay attention to this, the number of people coming in will fill these institutions beyond what is healthy and appropriate. And so the releases at the back end and the case processing strategies are the ways we're going to be able to control the population.
I would also add that we've pretty much maxed out on electronic monitoring. Whoever was able to go out on electronic monitoring remained out. In addition, when we released folks under the criteria that everyone's suggesting, if they at the House of Correction had electronic monitoring before, that opened up the ability to put somebody else potentially on electronic monitoring. So I think there's about 158 on EM. In addition, the last thing I would say about the criteria is we also certainly, for appropriate cases, victim notification was made so that we would include that voice in the process. And I don't think we had, many folks respond back, but enough that, you know, we certainly took that into consideration.
Do you think that there could be additional changes, and what additional changes would you like to see, if any?
Before, during, or after COVID?
Yeah.
Or not before? During.
Okay.
Well, there is one change that the chief signed in order, that if law enforcement comes in contact with individuals in the community who have a misdemeanor, rather than bringing them to the jail, they're told to contact their lawyer or the public defender's office rather than bringing them in, because, again, it's focusing on public safety. And right now, we want to save those limited spaces for people who are more of a public safety risk.
Yeah, I'd also on that, I would say we excluded domestic violence misdemeanors as well as firearm surrender hearings. And I think as today tragically plays out, you know, in our community, domestic violence seems to be ramping up and becoming more deadly. So we're very careful about some of the cases that we have or excluding others from some of the orders.
And in terms of some of the cases that you're, or some inmates that you're okay with or making priorities, does it include people that are older or people with immunocompromised or people with disabilities and health issues, even regardless of the kind of case that they have?
One of the lists that the House of Corrections has provided us is our inmates who have a high risk kind of profile in the way that you describe, and certainly those are ones that we've looked closely at.
And what about you know, anything else from a policy perspective besides DV cases that shouldn't be considered?
Well, the two exclusions, you know, the Chief Judge just mentioned, which are, you know, domestic violence and firearm surrender cases. And I'm sure that there might be a circumstance in which a law enforcement agency would want to have someone booked in, even though they would meet these criteria, and that's allowed for. So there may be some exceptions, but in general, misdemeanor cases are being ordered into out of custody intake court. They are not showing up as people being booked into the jail and brought through our central intake unit.
And what's your take on the cases that already exist at the House of Correction? I mean, there's a little cluster there. People were tested. It's already present. How are you reacting to that?
Well, first, I would say we were not surprised. We wish we had testing in there earlier. But, you know, until the Army Corps came with, you know, all their tools at to bear, you know, we were sort of you know, walking in a fog and in the dark about not knowing who actually was carriers. And what you find out in a lot of these institutions, it's not the inmates that are the carriers, it's the people, you know, the workers who go home, come back, go out into the community, come back and potentially spread it. But we knew it was there. We knew it was ultimately would have been there or could be there. And so testing was really important. Segregating people into certain pods was really key, and the House of Corrections did that. I think the most recent data we have is that the numbers have now flattened out and that there's no new ones in because of some of the policies and procedures they put in place there.
And jumping back to the how this is playing out in the criminal justice system, which courts are hearing these? Can you just tell me like a brief summary of the setup of how the court system is working and who is hearing these cases?
Carl did the nuts and bolts. I can tell you by March 14th, all of our courts were down, including the criminal courts, of which there's 23, 24 of them. But we knew we had to start processing some cases because, like I said, when we first came on, the unintended consequences of going down meant the house and the corrections and the jail population would go up. So Carl worked very hard with Tom and John and others to carve out some cases that we were going to do, and I'll let him describe that.
Judge Trujillo, is that because without people getting PR bonds and things like that, people had to remain in jail? Is that why the population went up?
Yeah, I mean, there was no movement in and out. There was no sentencings, no bail reviews, nothing until we set up the courts that Judge Ashley will talk about.
So, Mayor, what we had was 24 courts that handled criminal cases, and we went from 24 to 3. And so two of those courts were created specialized dockets, 8,000 to 7,000, to basically handle any kind of sentencings, pleas, bail modifications, mental health cases, and then a smattering of other things. But the idea was to keep us functioning so that we could take those cases. And so what the chief did was authorize that to take place. So we have intake prelim combined now. They used to be in two separate courts. Out of custody is no longer active at this point. And so then we had the other two courts that are manned by judges who are selected by the chief judge to rotate and go into those courts and handle that population. And it was just unbelievable what happened to change our process within a couple of weeks. It was amazing, and it only happened because of the collaboration with all our system partners, including the defense bar and Tom leadership in that, John obviously with his group, and the chief and the rest of the people working together, the bailiffs in the courtroom, the court reporters, the deputy clerks, all of those folks, by the way, kept coming down to this courthouse, even with the threat of COVID, to help us keep this process going. So I am extraordinarily grateful to those folks who stepped up to continue to do this hard work in the midst of this pandemic. And they came in faithfully, and there were nuts and bolts problems, no question about it. And now we're doing Zoom, which is, you know, one of those opportunities to have those contacts without having to move the client in and out, which was very important, particularly when we got a couple in the jail and also a lot in the house, so that it can protect people, not only the clients, but everybody else in the process as well. So it's been a monumental shift in what we've done, but it also has created opportunities for us to continue to do the hard work we need to do every day despite the pandemic. And now we also have an opportunity for live streaming so that the public can still be involved in the process.
Quickly about the district attorney's office's role, clearly you're charging the crimes and your whole team. What role, and there's the public health factor to take into account. What's the other calculus that you're relying on in these situations with all these cases coming in?
Right. So we quickly identified that there were certain cases that just had to be heard, and so with the total cooperation of what we call MCLEA, that's the Milwaukee County Law Enforcement Executives. So that's your 19 municipal police chiefs and other jurisdictions. What we asked them right away to do is not bring misdemeanor cases down to us, with the exception of those that pose danger. So the domestic violence cases, which are a major concern, they remain a very large concern. And the drunk driving cases, things like that. We basically asked them to change the way they did business as well. And so almost overnight, including the Milwaukee Police Department, they started e-filing their police reports so that we would still do a full review. There's nothing that we're not looking at, but we put the priority on the felony cases involving threats and assaultive behavior and things like that. So we've always kept that balance between public safety, although I now say that public health is public safety. There isn't a distinction between the two. But from our perspective, there are still individuals that we do not believe can be safely in the community until the case is adjudicated. So that's the priority we put on it. But we had to restructure the way we did business, because the other thing that I always have to keep in mind is that you have to protect your own people. We are no good protecting the public if there's a widespread outbreak within our office, among our support staff, who have been incredible. So one of the first steps we had to take was to make sure that we identified the people that were highest at risk in our office. My support staff is disproportionately African American, Hispanic, Latinx. They're a significant number of them that are older, and I was just very concerned that we take steps immediately to try to get them away from the courthouse complex. And then the county has been great. One of the distinctions most people don't know is that my attorneys are state employees. My support staff are all county employees. The attorneys we were able to satellite pretty quickly because they had laptops. We have a unified case management system that the state operates. So they were able to go home, and we were able, with some heroic work from our IT people, get them in the game fairly quickly. The support staff mostly operate off of desktops. And so, you know, working with the chief judge, working with IT management from the county, they actually got us about 60 laptops within the first week so that we could take some of our essential personnel and let them work from home as well. So taking care of my own people so they could take care of other people first and foremost. And then after that, making sure that we set up these structures where we could communicate with the courts. You know, some of the critical people from my side, you've heard of Jeff's role, Karen Label and Matt Torbenson, almost single-handedly converted us into a virtual office in the space of about a week. Tom Potter's been working closely on the misdemeanor cases. So I've had I think this weekend was the first weekend that we did everything that had to be done without a single DA actually being in the physical complex itself. But we're still doing warrants. We're still trying to resolve cases so that when the inevitable crush comes, when things open up again, that we're ready for that. And we're doing planning for that as well, because, you know, the reality is that the single biggest choke point in our system is always a jury trial, right? If you're facing lengthy time in prison, if you're asserting that you didn't commit the crime, there's only one way that that's resolved, and that's a jury trial. But the reality is, who wants to come into the courthouse for 8 hours sitting 6 inches away from another person? And that's going to be a challenge going forward, is to figure out how we can ramp that back up again. Because at the end of the day, that, you know, absent a vaccine being readily available, we're going to have a real challenge meeting that demand. And it's challenging for the defense bar as well. They you know, people would say, well, why don't you do it all virtually? Well, you know, there's a lot of things that you want to be able to control, particularly when you're dealing with a really serious case. For example, you don't want jurors on a Zoom conference looking at their laptops and seeing the full history of the defendant, for example, or reading Journal Sentinel articles or you know, WUWM listening to podcasts. You know, there's a lot of really basic things that you have to be really careful about when you're dealing with someone's constitutional rights. And so technology may not always be the answer to that. There are certain things that are still going to have to be done, you know, person to person. And that's going to be a challenge for us.
So going forward, do you all see that as the biggest challenge for this coronavirus and the criminal justice system? Or are there other ones when it comes to reducing the population and making sure that from a health, public health perspective, the jails are okay and MSDF is okay, that kind of thing?
As tragic as all of this pandemic is, on the bright side, I think there are going to be some systemic changes that addresses prison population, jail populations, although these are things that, particularly with jail, Milwaukee County's been working on for a number of years, and the Chief, John, and Tom have been very involved with that for a very long time. But I suspect that you're going to have, out of this horrible situation, some really positive outcomes about how we view the populations in custody.
I just have to ask you guys about that ACLU lawsuit that the Supreme Court just ruled against, you know, them, but basically they were arguing that it's not happening fast enough in the prisons, and that, you know, the prisons in the state of Wisconsin are still overcrowded. And I know we're talking about house of correction and jails, but overall, do you think that this process is happening as well as it can, as fast as it can?
You know, I'd be willing to take a stab at that one, and that we actually had the ACLU right at the table with us within the first week of the emergency declaration. And part of our strategy has always envisioned that we have to work, you know, we envision it sort of in a linear way. It's, you know, try to maintain single cells at the jail, try to control the spread in the House of Correction by reducing the population there. But then we also recognize that at some point in time, we're going to have to start sending people to the prison. And they have the least amount of legal or discretionary wiggle room. Those are people that are oftentimes lengthy sentences. And so we had already started that process with the Secretary of Corrections, with Kevin Carr and his team, with members of the Defense Bar and with the ACLU. And we're still committed to it. It's been put on pause a little bit because of the litigation, because the Secretary can't be discussing things that might be part of the litigation. But we've maintained a commitment to working with the Department of Corrections to reduce. For example, we've got a list of individuals that have, much like the House of Correction, if you have 6 months left in a prison sentence, for example, and you're going to be released back to supervision anyways, are those individuals that we could just simply say, hey, we'll just put that on to the extended supervision time. We'll just increase that amount of time and move them through. So we're still working on that and believe strongly in it as well. There's no, when you look at the list, one thing that's come out of it though is there really isn't a lot of low-hanging fruit there. We still have to make really tough decisions with people that are coming out of the prison system for really serious offenses. That's just something we have to remain committed to. And I do think that the structure that we've set up here is going to facilitate that. It's broken. I shouldn't say it's broken down. We've always had good relationships, but it's just added a sense of urgency to it that I think should remain in place going forward. And one additional thing I would mention is that we've also been working really closely to develop alternative care facilities for the inmates that we do have. And that's something that we've all invested our support and energies into as well. I would actually like to see that framework extend for two reasons. That is, what happens if it comes back again, which it very possibly could. And then secondly, I like the concept of having robust both physical and mental health resources for the people that are in our custody, whether it's pre-trial or post-trial, just having that capacity to deal with those issues at the local level. I could envision a time would come where we might feel comfortable even taking more serious violent offenses and handling them at the local level if there was the right resources in place to do that. It might require some changes in law, but I think that out of this experience, I would like to see us try to manage the Milwaukee County population locally to the extent we can. There are always going to be cases that, you know, if somebody's committed a homicide, a sexual assault, something like that, those are cases where the state prison system is just designed for that. But I think coming out of this, we should look very closely at expanding our capacity to safely supervise people at the local level, even if they're at a little bit more elevated risk.
No, I would say, you know, the power of positive collaboration and the energy that comes from that certainly has us really thinking about what the possibilities are from what we've already designed and are trying to put in play. The other thing, and I apologize, I had just to grab a phone call. I don't know if anybody said this, but, you know, the other part of releasing folks in the jail and the House of Correction, and mostly the House of Correction, was this really understanding that right now the community is struggling, right? There are a lot of things happening, like certainly there was lack of housing before, but even more so right now, there's lack of placements, lack of housing, lack of ability to do drug treatment, you know, and keep folks safe. So that went into the mix as well. Are we sending somebody out into the community has no place to stay, where the family can't take that person in because they're already, you know, quarantining themselves and they may have somebody there who's compromised or, you know, in that older population. So we were very careful about having those discussions with House, the jail, and the Department of Corrections, because we didn't want to make a bad situation worse. So that went into the mix.
Yeah.
And I'd add, Judge, the Department of Housing as well. You know, one of the first things they stood up was alternative housing for the homeless population at Clare Hall. And that, you know, again, I think it just reflects that we've been trying, you know, we're focused, Tom and I are focused on the criminal justice system. Mary and Carl have yes, the criminal system, but they also have to deal with you know, landlord-tenant issues and the civil system that can deeply implicate these issues as well. And they've been working really hard to make sure that we had options available for the both the homeless and the people at risk in housing. And I just mentioned Sojourner Family Peace has remained open, but it's clearly, you know, events like today are just an acute example of a trend that we've been seeing for a while, and that's an uptick in family violence related issues. And it's really troubling because it's contradictory advice, right? We tell people, if you're exposed to violence at home, come to us and we're going to provide you shelter and care and service and try to make you safe. But then now we're telling people stay home. And so it's really been a complicated and very troubling part of this pandemic that I think the brunt of the violence is being suffered silently at home, and so we're concerned about that. We've seen an uptick of about 15% in domestic violence referrals from the police. So I think that's something that we really have to continue to focus really hard on.
Yeah, our whole seventh floor is dedicated right now to doing in-person domestic violence civil injunction hearings, because we knew that was going to be a problem. So I have folks, you know, risking potential exposure up there who are there day in and day out trying to process these cases, but we knew it was important. So we had to figure out the social distancing piece and how people could file for their, you know, domestic violence injunctions, et cetera. So we as a community really, I think, understand the need to continue that work. Like we told you about carving out domestic violence warrants in terms of that system. So
we're going to have to come up with like a hidden heroes award about a year from now, when this is when we can look back on it. But yeah, there really are, you know, I think of people like Barry Phillips, for example, yeah, a court commissioner. He's shown up every single day to try to keep the continuity. You know, people like Tom and people like Jeff and there's, you know, it'd be for the non-electeds, but yep, there are just tons of people that are doing exceptional things each day that you would just never hear about, but we know.
You know, I want to do those signs that say heroes work here, but I also don't want to take away from the medical people who are doing even right, more of the hero job. But yeah, people are really, really coming to work, even under these arduous circumstances, continuing to do the cases that we need done.
Yeah, and I think
great crisis.
Yeah, and I think the thing to say about it is that I see no wavering in anyone's commitment. And I think we're in this for quite a while. And I think we will be, you know, functioning at a very high level consistently throughout, because I think, fortunately, people have a very high sense of duty around the system that we are involved in. And, you know, these are going to continue to be really difficult kinds of decisions that have to be made on a daily basis in order to just keep the thing afloat correctly. And people have rights, and those rights have to be honored and respected. And at the same time, there's a huge public safety and public health crisis that we're confronting. So it's fortunate that through all the preceding efforts, we have built up a lot of this collaborative capacity, because without it, I think we would be in a much worse place.
And Tom, really quickly, what do you see as the biggest challenge going forward, like throughout the, like during COVID and post-COVID?
Well, I think that we are going to continue to have, unfortunately, people who are arrested and charged with very serious offenses. And those individuals have to have, you know, their day in court and have resolution brought to the, you know, charges that have been placed against them. And I think it's just difficult, as John explained, to imagine right now how we could start convening jury trials and how we could do some of the things that are essential, you know, to make sure that those cases are taken care of. And so I think we, as the amount of time involved lengthens, you have to see more complexity attaching to some of those really serious cases. And they're serious for everyone. The community also needs to know what's happening, you know, and victims need to know what's happening with that, you know, that case. And right now there's just only a limited amount that can be done. So that is one of our ongoing challenges with this, for sure.
I'm sure you've probably looked at the daily update from the county, the COVID update. And what was significant about that is that they made a conscious decision early on to include demographic issue, including racial demographics. And what strikes me, and I've said this in discussions with other prosecutors around the country, what strikes me about that is that you could look at the current COVID map of Milwaukee County, and you could overlay that on top of any number of other maps that we've collected over the last 10 years, whether they're violent crime density, whether it's economic underservice, whether it's poor academic, you know, poor health outcomes, lead exposure, you know, you name it. You come up with the map, and you will find that the COVID map fits right on top of that very easily. And so one of our challenges going forward, I think, is going to be that as early as this Friday is going to be what I call the balkanization of the public health crisis, right? And that means that if the uniform directive from the state is lifted, it will become the responsibility of individual jurisdictions to address the COVID-19 problem. And that's going to have real implications, right? If they are up and running and doing jury trials in other parts of the state, and yet we're still experiencing a rise and uptick in COVID, that's going to create additional tensions and challenges. And so, one of our priorities has to be sticking together through this and maintaining this collaborative framework, because I don't think we can count on having a unified approach to this. You're not going to see it at the national level, and you may very well not see it at the local level, at the state level, I mean. But I'm hoping that we can keep it together at the local level to make sure that we do everything possible so that we can get back to a place where we can handle the cases in the most efficient way without having to put the brakes on and doing it all over again. Mm. I mean, that would be devastating.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you tomorrow morning.
All right. Bye-bye.